This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. How much could a sports legend born more than 120 years ago be influencing your life today? Lexington, Virginia-based biographer Kate Buford says, a lot, at least when it comes to the Native American who astonished the World Olympics almost 100 years ago. As the author shows in her incredibly detailed biography, Jim Thorpe was far more than a tragic sports hero who fell on hard times. You may have heard about the medals he won and lost, but chances are you don't know much about his astonishing post-Olympics athletic achievements, his dozens of Hollywood movies, or how, according to biographer Buford, Jim Thorpe's shadow can still be found all around us, if you know where and how to look. Biographer Kate Buford will be here to show us the way, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The book is titled Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. Its author is Lexington, Virginia-based writer Kate Buford. Ms. Buford, welcome to the Insight Studios.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, Kate, most people listening have at least heard of Jim Thorpe, and many are probably even vaguely familiar with the story of his being stripped of his Olympic medals almost 100 years ago. But could you begin, please, by giving a basic overview who he was and why you think this athlete born in the late 1800s is still of significance today?
Jim Thorpe was the first international celebrity athlete at the dawn of American and international organized sports. He remains the greatest multi-sport athlete we have ever seen. He was a fantastic collegiate football player when that game was being formed, the rules were being formed. A similarly great professional football player when that was the sort of bastard sport of collegiate football. Was the first president of the organization that would be the NFL. Played for Major League Baseball, high minor league baseball. He could do it all and did it all. And, of course, the 1912 Olympics, only the fifth Olympiad, brand new, the modern Olympics. He won the decathlon and the pentathlon by huge margins, gold medals for both of those sports.
Pentathlon no longer done today, so not
exactly.
Everybody knows what it is.
Yeah, the ten-event track and field showcase of the consummate athlete. In those days, too, track and field was considered the ultimate sports test. So everyone was watching both of those, the pentathlon, the five event, and the decathlon, the 10 event. And when he won them, he astonished the world. That was the first athlete to do that. And he became the toast of the world.
And this was a man who, we'll talk more about it, I'm sure. He developed his sports abilities at the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. And he'd focus mostly on playing football. And although Carlisle was supposedly a school that went up to high school, it was playing college ball against the big college names of the day, Harvard, Yale, West Point. You're nodding, so I guess I'm...
You're correct.
I'm remembering what I've read of your
yes,
book correctly.
Yes, you are.
But he had a football player's build. I mean, this was not a man that was built for running. He was big and thick and muscular in the chest and the shoulders, which I suppose was good for discus throwing.
Mm-hmm.
But he could jump and run. Well, one of his running records would stand for how long?
The 1500 meter time in the decathlon stood until 1972. As a decathlon Olympic time, yeah.
His little bit more than 4 minute time would stand for 60 years.
Right.
Can you imagine today an Olympic athlete
No.
for their mile run, in essence, standing for 10 years?
It's amazing. And it's the one I usually point to as saying, was he really good or not? I say, well, look at that record. That really speaks for itself.
And yet, my sense, Kate Buford, is that you did not decide to write this biography primarily because of sports.
No, I'd say sports was really important as a sector of American life, of American culture, that I thought had become so predominant. We use the metaphors of sports. We use the language of sports. We idolize sports heroes. And I thought in the last 25 years or so, certainly since Title IX, it's no longer a jock guy thing. It's girls, boys, men, women. It's everyone. And where did that start? And I wanted to investigate that. And I thought it started with Jim Thorpe, the first international celebrity athlete.
Native American?
Native American, born in Oklahoma, 1887.
What was then the Oklahoma Territory?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And 1887, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
So he was in his early 20s by 1912 at that landmark Stockholm Olympics?
Yes. Yes, he was in his 20s.
And was it less than a year that his international humiliation came to be?
It was 6 months after. The Olympics were in July of 1912. The newspaper scoop revealing that he had played professional sports in 1909 and 1910 in North Carolina. Baseball was January of 1913. So 6 months.
And tell us about that. He had been going to the Carlisle School for Indians, as was the politically correct term back the turn of the last century, for a number of years, but during the summers, he would try to make some money.
For two summers. And in fact, it's a complicated story, and people could read about it in the book.
I love that you said that.
Plug the book. He left Carlisle in 1909. He wanted to break into Major League Baseball. Again, going back to the beginning of sports, the only sport that really had a structure where you could make a career in 1909, 1910, before the 1920s, really, was baseball. It was organized in the last half of the 19th century. He left Carlisle, never intending to go back, wanted to break into baseball. So played professional baseball, not semi-pro or a bush league, under-organized baseball for minor league teams in Rocky Mount and Fayetteville.
Basically, this fairly low-level farm club teams.
Yeah, absolutely.
And didn't get paid all that much money.
It was a pretty good wage. It was more than the average mill worker was making in those towns.
Okay. So he played for what, 8, 10, 12 weeks a year?
Yes. But hoping to get scouted, and these games were heavily scouted by the major leagues. He hoped to break through. He wasn't quite good enough. Other players on those teams made it, but he didn't. So he goes back to Carlisle in 1911. He's run out of options. He goes back.
I know if I just sit here and look at you, you're going to tell me more about what happens next.
Okay, so he goes back. And his coach, both the track and field coach and the football coach at the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, was none other than Pop Warner, whom we know from the Pop Warner Football League, one of the most innovative, famous, successful football coaches. Not quite yet, but he will be. He'll go on to Stanford and really make his name. Warner wanted Thorpe back at Carlisle because the 1912 Olympics were coming up. And Carlisle had competed in the 1908 Olympics in London. And
the school, athletes
from the school had competed in the 1908 Olympics, which were in London. So the fifth Olympiad is coming up. Warner knows from the track season of 1909, just before Jim left, that he's got a great track and field athlete on his hands. And he was chagrined and frustrated, both for football, but also for track and field, that Jim had left the school. So he grabs him back and says, we need you for the football team. And by the way, I'm going to train you for the 1912 Olympic team and hope that, you know, you make it. And of course he did. So there was a lot of foot there in 1911 when Jim comes back.
But there also is a whole story about people who were competing in so-called amateur sports at the college level, who also had been playing baseball at the professional level during their summers. And for some reason, when Jim Thorpe does pretty much what everybody else was doing, goes to the Olympics, is hugely honored by America, sort of a turnaround in how America sees this Indian and how it sees a Native American as a hero, wins by incredible records. I mean, his total point score was like twice the next competitor.
Maybe not twice, but a huge margin. Yeah, for in the decathlon, for a total of 10,000 points, he made more than 8,000. I mean, it was phenomenal.
Nobody else came close.
No, not close at all.
And for some reason, 6 months later, they say, you broke the rules.
Well, it's more complicated than that. And again, you can read the intricacies in the book. But he intentionally went to become a professional. He did not change his name. He played under the name of Jim Thorpe because he never thought he was going back. the college players you refer to who routinely would play professional baseball to make some money during the summers, but also maybe to break into baseball, often changed their names. There were no social security numbers back then. You avoided the camera at all costs, which, of course, was relatively new back then, because if they took a picture of you, then they could compare your picture and figure out it was really you. It wasn't just Joe Blow.
So Jim Thorpe did what lots of other people were doing. He paid for breaking the rules because he wasn't smart about how he broke the rules?
That's part of it. He signed a form to play in the 1912 Olympics, which I have a copy of. The form said he had never accepted money of any kind to play any sport, either to play or to coach. That was the definition, very rigorous, of being an amateur. To compete in the Olympics, you had to be an amateur. And so he signed that form. To the extent he knew exactly what he was signing and the implications, that's where Pop Warner comes in. Pop Warner was completely conversant in what was going on. And Pop Warner, of course, eventually will leave Jim out to dry. Virtually abandon him.
Your book is filled with incredibly rich detail and much that comes after, not only in sporting accomplishments, but in movies and even in what I think can be termed civil rights activism mm-hmm. of Jim Thorpe's later life. And it's somewhere close to 400 pages plus 50 or 60 pages of footnotes. So that gives anybody listening just some idea of how in-depth you go. But I do recall that early on when you're describing what happened at the Olympics, there was a loophole that should have gotten him out of losing his medals.
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, the Swedes, the hosts of the Olympics in Stockholm, raised this. There was a period of time within which challenges could be made to any of the events at the Olympics.
30 days, if I recall.
30 days, absolutely. And of course, we're talking between July and January. Again, we go back, and that's one of the most interesting things for me about researching this book. You're going back to the earliest years of sports. There were no courts of arbitration. There was no recourse for Jim Thorpe. He had no advocate to stick up for him, as I would argue a Harvard or a Yale athlete would have had. He had only Pop Warner. And the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, Pop Warner, the American Athletic Union, none of them are going to take the fall
for
the scandal. They all turn on him and leave him to dry.
Even though they could have said, hey, we're past the 30-day barrier.
Yeah.
He keeps his medals.
And the Swedes raised that. They said, well, wait a minute. On the terms of procedure, and we were in charge of these Olympics, the time limit has passed. But that was ignored because America's reputation was on the line. And sports already were being conflated with national preeminence, national reputation, national dominance.
So to you who are listening, did you scarf up sports stats as a kid? I know I did. Our guest has written this amazing biography of the sports hero who was setting records even before statistics were being kept, not just in track and field, but in football, baseball, even basketball. If sports has affected your life in any way, do you see a connection between that effect and the legend of Jim Thorpe? Is there some other sports hero that has had discernible influence on your life's path? Your comments and questions welcome at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, you can find us listed as Virginia Insight. There's so much that you go into in so many different directions in order to portray the life of Jim Thorpe. You talk about what's going on in the 1800s, particularly in the late 1800s when he's born, and just before that time in terms of Indian relations. Mm-hmm. You talk about the formation of sports and particularly what's been happening with football. You talk about the Carlisle School and other Indian schools. I don't know why we're starting the music so early. We still got a minute to go. Pick one of those three to tell us a little bit about, and then we can get back to it when we're from the break.
We can start with Oklahoma and the wild, wild west of Oklahoma where he was born, which had a decisive impact on everything that happens in his later life.
And was there something about Jim Thorpe as an Indian that affects why you say his shadow continues in our world today?
Yes, the emphasis on athletic achievement and the freedom he had to try anything on the plains of Oklahoma, to run as fast as a jackrabbit, to run over fences, to compete with all of his friends. He just grew up doing that.
Okay, now we have to go to the break, and we'll get more in 60 seconds. Her previous biography was about an iconic Hollywood movie idol. That book titled Burt Lancaster, An American Life. Lancaster, of course, starred in an early 1950s epic about Jim Thorpe, and it was while doing research on the Lancaster biography that she became intrigued with the information that kept cropping up about the Olympics legend. Eventually, after the rave reviews about having written a seminal biography of a little-understood movie star died down, Kate Buford went back into research mode. The result is this in-depth, detailed piece of literature we are discussing today titled Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Call-in phone number 888-WMRA-TALK. Jim Thorpe, a sign of some major kind of transition that was going on in America as we go from the late 1800s into the early 1900s. Tell us about that.
It's a huge transition. In fact, I'd say it goes all the way up to the 1920s. Sports, which is emerging at this time, becomes the symbol of so much else. As I just mentioned, it becomes a symbol in the Olympics of international predominance. It becomes conflated with nationalism. But for the man in the street, and it was still mostly men who played sports then, sports was a chance on an open playing field with no favor to show that you could excel against anyone. And what happens with Jim, and one of the reasons that he's remembered so vividly, even now, but certainly back when he was stripped of his medals, he was seen as the outsider being robbed of his due by an exclusionary establishment, by the big boys who were rigging the game to suit them. And even though there was this rush to judgment in January 1913, the average person in the street and the average reporter and sports writer smelled a rat. And so you get this beginning, which is one of the major reasons I was struck by the story when I was doing the research for Lancaster. You get this hunger for vindication. Here was the outsider who was wronged. Yes, he was an American Indian, but he could have been Jewish. He could have been Italian. He could have been Irish. He certainly could have been black. All of these groups identified with this Native American who was the greatest of all and shamed before the whole world.
What else do you think people may not know about Jim Thorpe that they should know? At least in terms of why you think he's continuing to affect our world today.
He is the paradigm, and that's one, again, one of the reasons that attracted me to his story. He's the paradigm of the athletic wonder boy who triumphs with his body and triumphs in sports, but who has a great deal of trouble negotiating real life when the body starts to fail. We see this over and over and over again. A person with great gifts like Tiger Woods, for example, or Brett Favre, who yet has trouble figuring out how to lead a decent life off the field. Jim was the first person who went from soup to nuts on that. We'll see many others as the decades go by. But his life forms a series of patterns that I thought, without beating the reader over the head, you can read this story and draw your own conclusions and say, oh, well, that's like so-and-so, or that's like so-and-so. He's the first to do all this on the public stage, and all his life, reporters will follow him to do an update on the greatest athlete the world has ever seen. So his personal life is never out of the public eye.
Is it your contention that especially his influence on football, both before and after he went to the 1912 Olympics, was part of what made that sport what it is today?
Oh, absolutely. Again, going back in time, you have to look at the early years of the 20th century. Football was exclusively collegiate and exclusively Northeastern elite schools.
So
Harvard,
it was basically
Yale, Princeton. Again, we're talking an elite, and the game was, the rules were formed by Walter Camp at Yale. They were argued out among these top schools. Slowly, the sport migrates west to the rest of the country.
So to understand what a big deal it was for Jim Thorpe and his fellow Native Americans to be beating Harvard from this basically high school for Indians
if
in
even,
Pennsylvania.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I guess we need to understand a little bit more about what the Carlisle Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania was.
Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania was a boarding school, a Native American boarding school for boys and girls. It was part of a now, what now seems like a radical assimilationist movement to, it was thought by white reformers, to save the so-called vanishing, that was a favorite word, vanishing American Indian race. And the way that they were going to save them was to turn them into whites, was to eradicate their native language, dress them up as whites, teach them white culture and manners and speech, and this would save these dying peoples, indigenous peoples. So the most radical way to do that was to take Indians like Thorpe from the West and move them to the East to a school like Carlisle, where they were forced to stay for 5 years, couldn't go home, could not speak their native languages, were dressed in military uniforms if they were boys, calico dresses if they were girls, and were given the equivalent of up to about eighth grade education, and took vocational courses. Many of them went on to go to high school and then to college and to law school, but the basic thrust of these network of Indian boarding schools was to turn them into whites.
And Carlisle was the most famous.
Was the most famous, yes.
And at some point in time, this character, Pop Warner, who would later become famous for his activities as a coach at different college football centers, mm-hmm. is making a name for himself as football is being created. And the rules are changing, and the kind of brutal, violent game that was being played back in the early 1900s was almost unrecognizable compared to what it is today. But Pop Warner came in, what, as the athletic director for the Carlisle
yeah.
Indian School?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he decided to get in on football. And then what happened?
Well, he had already coached and played football at Cornell. He went to Cornell as an undergraduate. He comes to coach at Carlisle in the late 1890s, leaves for a while, and then comes back. And that's when he hooks up with Jim Thorpe. Again, going back to this tight little fraternity of Northeastern schools, Carlisle, as you just said, there was no NCAA. So an aggressive promoter like Pop Warner got the Carlisle Indian Industrial School on the schedules of Yale and Harvard and West Point and Syracuse and Penn. Penn was the big rival. At the same time, this really brutal game where there were many fatalities. Teddy Roosevelt calls a little conference in 1905 at the White House to save the game. It was going to be banned by the president of Harvard.
And let me underscore that. You didn't say injuries. There were
no,
many
deaths, fatalities. Yes, yes. Including Archer Christian at University of Virginia in 1909. The deaths horrified people. This was the time when, you know, the muckrakers were in full force on many sectors of American life. And death was not an option, particularly not for elite college boys. So the rules essentially change the game, are forced to change the game from this mass momentum, brutal, stomping, deadly game to a much more open game where you have a line of scrimmage which keeps players from massing at the back. You have the forward pass legalized, which, I mean, for decades, the diehard football guys thought that was a sissy play. You know, you had to charge through the line. You didn't throw the ball over it. But all of
you
these innovations.
You basically had to play rugby, only a little bit more violent.
Yes, there you go. Yeah, well, of course, football evolved from rugby. So the game with Pop Warner pushing the rules every single year and then having being slammed down the next year by the rulemakers, the game is changing by the year to balance to find the right balance, rather, between offense and defense and to make it less dangerous. So by 1910, remember, Jim comes back to Carlisle in 1911, already having made his mark as a football player, but he really becomes a phenomenon in 1911.
Tell us about Jim Thorpe as a football player. What was it that was so remarkable about him, and how was it that Pop Warner felt he could basically build a career on top of Jim Thorpe's abilities?
Well, it's a fascinating symbiosis. You have a great coach and a great player who meet at the right time in history. It's one of the great symbioses of sports history. Jim was a running back, and his running skills, which, of course, we will see in the Olympics, come into the fore, particularly as the game opens up.
So he was incredibly fast.
Incredibly fast. But he also had a unique style of running, of pumping his legs up and would not be tackled. I mean, there's the famous story of him showing up for the first football practice at Carlisle, and Warner didn't want him on the football team. He wanted to keep him protected for the track team. But Jim was determined to get on the football team. And Warner set up this tackle practice and told Jim to run through the team to do a tackle practice. He was supposed
because
to let
Pop
himself
Warner
be.
Warner thought that he would flunk out.
He would easily be tackled. And Jim just dodged his way through the whole group.
Very first time on the football field, he could not be tackled.
Could not. And he came back, and Warner goes, excuse me, Jim, you're supposed to let them tackle you. I mean, that's the whole point. And Jim says, no one tackles Jim. He always referred to himself in the third person. No one tackles Jim. So he was famously impervious to physical injury, which, of course, sets up a pretty dangerous model, which we live with today. But also, he just he could repel tacklers, both by this method of running, but also he had a kind of a straight arm push with his hand that was not carrying the ball. And he also had, and this is what Warner learned to recognize and leave alone, particularly in 1911 and 1912, he had fabulous instincts on the football team, on the football field. And I liken it to someone who, the more sedentary parallels, but someone who's really good at geometry or really good at chess. You know, you look at the geometry problem and you see the solution. You look at the chess board and you see the solution. Jim could get on the football field and he saw the play. He saw the solution in ways that astonished even Warner.
And these were the days when most players, most of the time, played defense and offense mm-hmm. throughout the game.
Mm-hmm.
And not only because he could run and he could avoid being tackled and he could carry the ball and repeatedly score touchdowns, but when he played defense, there were stories about when he tackled somebody.
They stayed tackled, right? Or he knocked them out. This became more prevalent in the pro game when he goes in 1915 to Canton, Ohio, which was a center of this ragtag sort of bastard sport of professional football. He becomes the coach and the player for the Canton Bulldogs, and they win the so-called, I mean, there was no real championship then, the championships for the next several years. Puts that sport on the map because he's so famous that sports reporters around the country follow the Canton Bulldogs because Jim Thorpe is playing for the Canton Bulldogs. And he then routinely knocks Newt Rockne and several other of the players we would come to know so well later.
Fellow by the name of Dwight
cold.
Eisenhower.
Dwight Eisenhower, that was, yes, for playing for West Point with Carlisle. Yeah, he actually let Dwight and another West Point player hit each other. And they sort of collided with each other and were taken out of for the rest of the game.
And you write, Kate Buford, in your book, Native American Son, that some 20 years or more later, when Thorpe was in his 40s, and he would occasionally play in some sort of pickup or celebrity old-timers game.
Mm-hmm.
You quote some people who would be hit by him as a tackle and say something like, I felt it for days afterwards. I can't imagine what it would have felt like when he was in his prime.
Absolutely. If players like Red Grange, who became very famous at the end of the 1920s, was another person who put pro football on the map. Ernie Nevers from Stanford.
So this was somebody with almost unimaginable athletic ability.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about how his score was just astronomical at the Olympics in the decathlon. We've talked about how football basically got built around him. We haven't talked much about the fact that he would also eventually succeed to some degree as a baseball player. He even played basketball
mm-hmm.
some.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the Carlisle Indian School and Pop Warner, there are some nefarious things about this character who helped make Jim Thorpe's career, aren't there?
You mean Pop Warner?
Yeah.
Yeah, Pop Warner's a complicated guy. Pop Warner was out for Pop Warner. Pop Warner himself was an outsider. He was always trying to push into this elite world of Yale and Harvard and the people that controlled the football game and the rules. He was looking out for number one. He was not going to sacrifice his career for Jim Thorpe. He treated the Indian players very roughly. There would be a congressional investigation of the school after Jim left, which I go into in the book, which is heartbreaking to read. Heartbreaking to read the transcript. It's down at the 42nd Street Library, where the varsity football players got a petition together at Carlisle and took it to their congressman and said, you must investigate our school. In particular, you must investigate our coach.
Pop
because
Warner.
He is doing things that are not worthy of this school.
Because he was so brutal?
He was so brutal.
He
was taking money on the side. He had this athletic fund that no one quite knew what happened to it or with it. The whole money trail has gone into in detail in the congressional report. And it's after that investigation that Pop Warner leaves Carlisle and goes to Pitt and then goes to Stanford and becomes one of the most famous football players, collegiate football coaches.
I'm just curious for you on the other side of your radio. Have you previously given much thought to how sports affects our culture? Even if you're not much of a fan, does sports lingo ever enter your everyday language? Might you have any speculations or questions about how things might have been different if America had never had a Jim Thorpe? If you're willing to share your thoughts with us, 888-WMRA-TALK is the phone number, 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Kate Buford, author of Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe, is our guest. Quote from you, Kate. Let me see if I've got this correctly. Sports is not the sideline to our culture. It is our culture.
Right.
Explain that.
Well, it was interesting. Having done this book on Lancaster, a book about a movie star and a movie producer.
Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster, yes, who played Jim Thorpe in Jim Thorpe All-American. I was convinced after I wrote that book that movies are not so-called popular culture. They are our culture. Movies are who we are. And similarly, sports. There's been, and I think it's ending now, there's been a tendency to have sort of so-called high culture topics and popular culture topics. Popular culture somehow deemed to be lesser. And I found with sports, one of the main reasons for doing the book, that sports are who we are. We use, as we talked earlier, we use their language. I was thinking most recently of when Osama bin Laden was killed. President Obama, when he was pressured to release the photographs of the killing, said, no, we're not going to spike the football. And I thought, well, isn't that remarkable that there's a football terminology used by the president of the United States talking about one of the seminal events probably of our time. And that began 100 years earlier. What's important, too, to realize, and I think this is why, again, I thought I was fascinated to do sports history and to put it in this book. When the frontier, the American frontier, was declared over in 1890, which meant that there was a certain density of population across the country, there was this convulsion of anxiety at the highest level of this country. And politicians, university presidents, philosophers, what was going to take the place of the frontier for white America? What was going to forge the American character? What would take its place of the frontier and the pioneer experience? And sports emerges as the replacement for the frontier. And people see it as that. They see sports as being the crucible that will define American, in those days, manhood, and set America up as a world player. And football preeminently becomes the sport, the territorial sport that mimics the fight for land, but also was seen as inculcating the elite at Harvard and Yale and all those the colleges that were playing football at the time, with the strengths of strategy and skill that they would need to rule the world.
Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a good question. It certainly invested football with enormous importance. Enormous importance.
But you're saying that that change in our culture, that model of what America was about, it would largely, in your view, be based on development of sports and then our attitude towards sports, is with us today. So I'm going to let you think some more about whether you think it was a good thing or a bad thing. You can hear from the music. We have to pause for a break. We'll be back with biographer Kate Buford in 1 minute. Lexington, Virginia-based writer Kate Buford is our guest. Her newest book is titled Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. Our guest says the impact of Thorpe's life can still be felt in our world today. Agree? Disagree? 1-888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825 to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight. So, your theory? That sports is overwhelmingly affected our culture, that it's happened largely as a result of the changes that happened in America in the early 1900s many of them spearheaded by the hero worship of Jim Thorpe and his amazing athletic achievements. And my question was, results of that you see as good or bad?
I see it was potentially good and actually good in many ways. Sports taking the place of the frontier. Sports was seen as this open playing field that theoretically that anyone could come and compete as an equal with anybody else, and the best man would win. That's part of the power behind Thorpe's story, is that, as we discussed earlier, people saw that he was not allowed to win on a fair and open playing field, that he was robbed of his honors for reasons that were...
And you think that was because he was a Native American?
No, I think it was more that he was the outsider. He happened to be a Native American, but if he'd been Jewish or Italian or any of the other outsider groups, he would have been similarly treated. He had no advocate. He couldn't stand up to this establishment, which was formidable. The American Olympic Committee, as it was called then, the American Amateur Union, the IOC, these were all very elitist organizations, very powerful organizations. There was no way that he could hold his own against those organizations at all.
As you detail in your biography of him, Kate, Jim Thorpe would eventually father several children.
Mm-hmm.
And as you document, he seemed to have a somewhat strained relationship with many of them, at least after they reached adulthood. Was it possible that what affected him even more as a young man than that international humiliation of being stripped of those Olympic medals was the death of his first son?
Oh, I'd say so, yeah, yeah. His teammates and closest friends from Carlisle, who remained his friends all his life, said that Jim was never the same after his firstborn son died at the age of three of inflammatory rheumatism, and it was a devastating, very quick death. And coming on the heels, I mean, a few years after the humiliation of the Olympic scandal, nevertheless, he had seen this little boy. It was his firstborn child.
Named after him.
He called him Junior. As being his future, his real monument, as he called him, what he could build toward. And when this was yanked away from him, it ruined him. It really changed him. With the result that he has seven more children, and he's always, it seemed to me, afraid of getting very close to any of them for fear that they would be yanked away as well.
How many wives did he have?
He had three.
The third of which, I think you opened a chapter by saying he woke up in a bed in Tijuana one morning and the woman lying next to him said, "Don't you remember? We got married last night."
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And she actually would stay married until he died.
Oh, yes, absolutely. She becomes the widow, and she is the one who is in charge of, legally, the body. And that's a whole story that the listenership may be aware of from the recent federal lawsuit trying to get the remains taken back from Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, to Oklahoma.
And has a lot to do with how Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania got its name. But before we get to that, around the time he gets into this drunken marriage that ends up lasting, his third marriage, is that when he is in the midst of his movie career?
No, the movie career starts in 1930, 31 technically. He goes out to Hollywood on a Bunyan Derby, which was a funny 1920s stunt of running across the country with various runners, and he's one of the moderators. He arrives out in Southern California in 1930, only to discover two things. One, that there's work in the movies, and this is a depression, remember, particularly for former athletes, because they can move well, they can follow directions well. He has a famous name, so that means he has marquee value, even if it's only as an extra. And it's a very nice climate out there. I mean, more sports stars, former sports stars, end up in Southern California than anywhere else in the 1930s.
And this may be the biggest thing that will surprise people in reading your book about the life of Jim Thorpe, is that he appeared in how many movies?
70 plus that I could find, and that was more than anyone else had found. It may be many more than that, because the records for some of these uncredited extras are lost.
And you refer to the fact there was some claim that couldn't be documented, but some advertising claim somewhere around the way that said that he'd appeared in 147.
Exactly, yeah.
And some of these were pretty famous. He was in King Kong.
He was a native dancer, and it's hard to find him, but he was in King Kong. He was in She with Helen Gehagan Douglas and Randolph Scott, which is a, a wonderful film to watch now.
He was in at least one of the Hope and Crosby movies?
Yes, Road to Utopia. Yep, and he was quite close with Bob Hope. Bob Hope was a friend, and Bob Hope lent him money from time to time.
And this is where he touches upon a civil rights career.
Yes, yes. Native American rights, or Indian rights as they were called then. Because he's so famous, he becomes the center of this diaspora of Indian players, Indian actors, stuntmen who arrive out in Hollywood to appear in the newly popular, repopularized because of the sound, Western serial. And they're playing hokey, stereotypical Indians, but it's work, and they make a lot of them. They're churned out by, you know, Gower Gulch, so-called, in Hollywood, by the hundreds. And he becomes, because he's so famous, he becomes the spokesman for these Indians. And he starts pressuring, forms a casting company, and begins to pressure the studios in the 1930s to hire real American Indians to play Indians in these hokey Westerns, rather than Mexicans or Italians or anyone who's vaguely ethnic looking. And the studios are none too particular. They don't care. But Jim says, look, if you want to hire someone who can really ride a horse and shoot an arrow at the same time, hire one of my group of Indians, and they become known as the Jim Thorpe Indians.
But there's quite a bit of agitations about this. There's talk in Congress. There's letters to the president saying, if you're going to be fair to Native Americans who are being portrayed so poorly in movies anyways as image, the least you could do is make sure that the actors who portray Indians are Indians.
Yes, exactly.
And a lot of that is Jim Thorpe's doing.
A lot of it's doing. And also, again, coming back to the economic times, it was work. And it was cutthroat competition for these, even an uncredited extra job. It was money. And he said, give us the money, give us the jobs.
So to you who are listening, Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, Dolly Madison, Babe Ruth, all are American legends with names recognized by most U.S. school children. Do you think there is something in particular that makes someone a legend, especially a heroic one? Do we have such people in the making in our world today? How do you think someone like Jim Thorpe would fare in this world? 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825 if you want to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight. How do you think, Kate Buford, that Jim Thorpe would fare in today's world?
That's a really good question. It's a totally different sports world now. And one of the most poignant things about Jim's story is that he's the greatest ever and still showing up on polls. You know, not hardly a month goes by without him still being rated the top multi-sport athlete. But his greatest feats were before 1920, before radio, before movie newsreels, certainly, obviously, well before television, before the flowering of American sports writing, which is the 1920s.
Before most statistics and records of sports were marked down and kept.
Absolutely, absolutely. Baseball had statistics that early, definitely, because it was off and running by the end of the 19th century. But the other sports that he's in, and the one set of records that could still exist, are the 1912 Olympic records. But those were stricken in 1913 when he is stripped of his medals and his records, and they have never been put back.
Some people will be surprised by that, because there were this news in the early 1980s that he was getting posthumously his medals back.
And,
posthumously.
Yeah.
That's the word.
Posthumously.
Yes.
Yes, that's one of the interesting little bits of Olympic hypocrisy. In 1982, and it's quite a long road up to that, but the point is that the feeling that he'd been wrong didn't die. So finally, Bob Wheeler and Flo Ridlon and a big committee, these are two people that were involved in writing a biography of Thorpe, and wonderful people, put together a successful initiative, but it wasn't really reinstatement. What happened was, in 1982, of course, Thorpe's long dead, the original second and third place winners in 1912 were, in 1913, booted up. Everybody moved up. They didn't move them back down. So if you go on the IOC website today, you will see two gold medal winners for the pentathlon and the decathlon. And Thorpe is just listed as a contender.
They don't list his records.
No. And the medals were recast from the original mold, and duplicates were given to his family in 1982. So, as Sports Illustrated said in 1983, Thorpe remains the ultimate asterisk in sports history.
I take it that at one point, based on what you wrote in your book, A Native American Son, the life and sporting legend of Jim Thorpe, that you saw or reviewed that section of the King Kong movie where Jim is playing an Indian chieftain dancing alongside King Kong.
Well, a native dancer. This is sort of a South Sea island.
He I take it that what struck you there was some sort of connection between the whole storyline of King Kong and Jim Thorpe's life.
Yeah, it's probably a stretch, but I'm looking at him playing this incredibly stereotyped, and even for Hollywood, King Kong is stereotyped. You see him playing this native dancer, besieging the gates of King Kong's holdout on this island. And of course, for those who've seen the movie, you know that King Kong, the gorilla, the monster gorilla, is captured and brought to New York, and he's put on a stage and shown off, and the bright glare of the reporter's flashbulbs enrages him. He breaks his chains, climbs to the top of the Empire State Building, and I couldn't help but see a parallel, because Jim hated what he called the public glare. He only wanted to lead a private life, but he's put on display, like almost like a freak, you know,
well,
someone who's so great.
There were times when he showed up at like flea circuses.
Yes,
to
later
stand
in
there
his life,
just in order to feed his children.
Absolutely, yeah. Hubert's flea circus in Times Square. Again, fast forward only 10 years after his greatest feats, and you have phenomenal amounts of money being paid to Babe Ruth, Jack Dempsey, Red Grange, Bobby Jones. The whole culture of sports changes almost as soon as he's finished with his glory years. And this both gives his story a poignancy and also creates an aura that's outside of history around his name.
It seems to me that you leave open a question in this lengthy biography that strikes me as something like this. How much of the tragedy of the Jim Thorpe legend is because of what his world did to him, and how much of it is because of what he did to himself? Do you leave that open on purpose?
Well, it's the classic question of Greek drama, you know, hubris. I mean, to what extent are the seeds of our own destruction within ourselves? This is an ancient, ancient question, and I think any biographer has to look at it. With Thorpe, it's back and forth. To a great extent, he could have handled his life better himself, theoretically.
Did he really stand a chance?
Absolutely he stood a chance, yes. I mean, several of his classmates went on to be very successful coaches, lawyers, teachers. He was, as Pop Warner said, a happy-go-lucky athlete who never changed. And that's something I think we can see today. He wasn't trained or encouraged to do anything else. He was too good. And again, the public glare made it impossible for him to have a private life, whereas his other classmates who went on for successful lives did it privately. He, if anything, was ruined by his fame, I would say.
Bill in Charlottesville, you made it in just under the wire. If you could ask your question or comment quickly, please.
Yeah, I was commenting on your statement about whether somebody could survive now in the environment today. And I feel that we, with the sort of 48-hour news cycle, I call it, that there's no way for anybody to have a long enough arc to do things. We pull them up, cheer them on, and then tear them down sort of in the next news cycle. I don't see how today's heroes are going to, muddle through that.
That's a very good point. And I think Thorpe had the luxury, if you will, of being able to develop so many different sports and develop them fully. Before we end, I should say that he did master that curveball in baseball and was hitting as well as Ty Cobb and Joe Jackson by 1919. But the point is very well taken. I mean, he just today would be very well paid for whatever he did, but would not have a chance to develop as he did back in his day. That's a very good point.
Bill, thank you so much. Before we close, I've heard you say before, Kate, that this really isn't so much a story about sports or a story about culture or the story about one amazing man. It's a story about humanity.
It is. It's about a person who accomplished great things, was an incredible athlete, but more than that, people wanted to believe in him and his story and his reputation and his name had such a force behind them. That's one of the main reasons I wrote the book, is to answer why. I could tell that from the file at Warner Brothers for the movie. Why did people care so much when he hadn't played a game in decades? He symbolized a great deal. He symbolized the greatest ever, deprived of his due honors. And everyone could sympathize with that.
Kate Buford has been our guest. Her newest book is titled Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. Kate, thank you so much for making time for us.
You are welcome, and thank you.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org and then clicking on Programs and then clicking on Insight Archives. If you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work that Ms. Buford has been doing. And if you like us on Facebook, you'll get access to a whole bunch more information about Virginia Insight there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.